Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. One of my favorite politicians, one of the people for whom I have the greatest respect in the world of politics, has been for well over a decade, Keith Ellison. He was the Attorney General of Minnesota prior to that, and he was on this program regularly. He was Minnesota's represented Minnesota's 5th Congressional District in the U.S. House of Representatives. And he has a new book out titled Breaking the Wheel, Ending the Cycle of Police Violence, that is just an absolutely extraordinary look. Mostly it centers around the George Floyd killing and the trial that was involved with that, because Keith Ellison himself was very involved with that. And I think it's really a very important book. And so on the line with us is Keith Ellison himself. Yeah. I just have to, I read your book, Break the Wheel, usually Ending the Cycle of Police Violence. It's not often that I have an opportunity to actually read the book of the person that I'm interviewing. And you did such a great job with this book. You start out talking about, you know, getting the call about what was happening with George Floyd. You want to speak to that, how you know, where you were, what you were doing, where you were in your life at that point, and why this was such a consequential call.
Well, you know, it was it was May 26, early morning hours, and I get a text message from my assistant. This is our outreach director, 26-year-old guy, and he says, "You must watch
this." It was about 4:40 in the morning. I'm one of those people who start yawning and needing to get some sleep right around 8 o'clock at night. But in the 4:40 in the morning, I'm buck wide awake, ready to go. I got this call and I just couldn't believe it. I was riveted to what I was seeing. I said to my wife, I said, "Honey, you got to see this." She said, "I don't want to see this." And I just kept watching this and playing it over and over again. And I'm not sure why I needed to just keep on watching this. Maybe it's because I was not believing what my eyes were showing me, but that's when I saw it. And that morning, I started sending out text messages to my staff that we had to meet first thing about this. At that point, it was not our case. It was the county's case. At that point, we didn't know what role we could play, but we needed to gather the facts and offer our services to be of benefit to whoever and whatever we could.
Right. And you write about how this was at Cup Foods at 38th Street and Chicago Avenue. And in 1997, yeah, just three blocks south, Lawrence Miles Jr., 15-year-old, had been shot in the back and nearly bled to death by a police officer named Charles Storley, who was then right. apparently congratulated for what he did rather than punished for it. In fact, the young man who was shot never got any compensation. Another one, Dewey Noe, who was also shot by that same police officer, ultimately committed suicide right. after going through all these surgeries. Philando Castile, you talk about, you know, when he was killed by a St. Anthony police officer, Geronimo Yanez. This is not unique to Minnesota or Minneapolis even. This is a nationwide problem, our policing, the violence associated with policing in America. And, you know, I have to say, I lived in Germany for a year back in the 80s and you know, had a couple of encounters with the police. They were always friendly. It was always cordial. There was no sense that we lived in a police state. And yet, here in the United States, there is that sense. What is your sense of where this comes from? Is this all a vestige of the old slave patrols and that being kind of the foundation of American policing? Or is this, does it have to do with the psychology of people who want to become police officers? What's going on in this country that's so different from pretty much every other developed democracy in the world?
Well, let me tell you, this is the question, right? I think certainly the legacy of the slave patrol is at work. That is a part of it. There have been a number of major steps forward in policing, professionalization, things like that. But those roots that they're going to use the police force to maintain a vertical hierarchy between one group and another, I think is still at work. But it's not just race. Also, don't forget, you know, Pinkertons and union busting and maintaining the authority of the union bosses, the factory bosses. And I'm from a city called Detroit, Michigan, where there was a long history of, you know, the factory owners having a lot of control over law enforcement against the striking trade unionists. I mean, and then, you know, it's not just those two. It's even more than that. I mean, in the southwest part of our country, there's the history of the Texas Ranger and there's the Indian fighter. There's no doubt that part of our culture of policing is the idea that the police are there to protect one group against another, and as opposed to the mission of just protecting and serving everyone. In England, for example, you know, we talk about the Bobbies. Well, this is a group that has emerged from Robert Peel, who sort of shifted policing after he saw that the military was doing policing. And he said, no, the military should not be doing policing because the military's job is to fight and win wars against the enemy. So he then comes up with the shift in policing to be in a service that is a little bit more inclined to protect people than to be adverse to them. And so, you know, I think in Europe, the police department is there to, you know, keep the peace, whereas in the United States, it has a lot of mixed histories. Part of it is to keep the peace. Another part of it is to maintain a vertical hierarchy. And I think we're living with that legacy now. And I just think that's part of how we're going to break the wheel in the cycle of police violence, is to really make this shift from, you know, police versus community to police in tandem with and in partnership with community to maintain, peace and to maintain safety for all. Yeah. But we've yet to fully make the change.
You write in your book, you mentioned Detroit, and I my eyes widened when I read this, that, you know, in 67, you were 3.5 years old. I'm about 15 years older than you, I think. And that same neighborhood, the apartment building that I lived in with my mother and father when I was a year old, from the time I was a year old until I was around 3 years old, burned down in the 1967 riots in Detroit. And at that time, that at least that building was kind of a Jewish ghetto at that time, and then it later became black. And as you know, 43 people died in that riot, and
right.
What was characterized as a riot. It was really an uprising against police violence again. To the best of my knowledge, there has never been one of these, you know, what the media likes to portray as black riots, that wasn't actually a response to a police, to an incident of police violence.
Well, that's the conclusion the Kerner Commission came to.
That's right.
What you just said, the Kerner Commission, which studied all of these cases of civil unrest, came to the conclusion that it was a lot of things, housing, poverty, all these things. But the spark of the kindling were these very tragic interactions between police and members of the black community. And in the case of Detroit, there was an after-hours drinking establishment, and the police came in there hard and heavy, and people just were tired of it and reacted. And that became the most expensive, most tragic riot in that nation's history, in our nation's history, up to that time.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
So you can't really separate these urban uprisings, rebellions, civil unrest, whatever name you want to call them. Your politics sort of indicates how you see it, as we both know. But whatever you want to call it, you can't separate policing from that, right? They're linked. And I think that in order to end the cycle of police violence, you got to deal with those underlying problems, but you also have to deal with the policing. And I can tell you that we should not be pessimistic. We should believe that there are changes that can happen that'll benefit the community and police. There are things happening that we could do, and we should be optimistic about ending the cycle of police violence. But it will require changes, and we're going to have to accept that if we want to stop this cycle of violence.
Yeah, I absolutely agree, and I want to get into those in just a moment. We've got to take just a real quick break here. It'll just be a few seconds, and we'll continue our conversation. We're talking with Keith Ellison. His new book, Break the Wheel, Ending the Cycle of Police Violence, is absolutely a must-read book. It's brilliant. Eric Holder writes, an intimate account of a truly consequential courtroom confrontation, an unforgettable reading experience. I agree. We'll be right back with Keith Ellison. Hang on.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We're talking with Attorney General, former Congressman Keith Ellison. Stay tuned. You talk in your book about how your mother was one of the 100,000 people who died from COVID in May of 2020.
Yep.
I've written a couple of pieces about this, and they've never really caught the kind of national attention I think this issue deserves. On April 7th of 2020, that was about a month after Donald Trump had declared an emergency and shut down the country. On April 7th, the New York Times and the Washington Post both led their papers that day with headlines, front page headlines, saying that the majority of people who were dying from COVID were black. That led the news on ABC, NBC, CBS, and CNN and MSNBC. I checked them all. Within a week, the Trump administration had said, essentially, oh, my God, it's mostly killing black people. OK, that's the end of the pandemic. We need to get back to work. We need to force people back to work. These right wing groups, the freedom, whatever it is, the funded by the right wing billionaires, they came out with a plan to put people back to work. I mean, literally within 1 week of that headline coming out saying it's mostly killing black people. The entire demeanor of the Trump administration changed. And the result of that, according to research done by the British journal Lancet, was 500,000 unnecessary deaths. You know, according to Trump's own, the woman who was working for him, I'm forgetting her name now, who wore the scarves all the time, she said it was 300,000 unnecessary deaths. I'm so sorry to hear about the death of your mother, but do you think that there will ever be accountability for the way that Trump screwed this thing up? Apparently because he thought that he could exploit it racially. In fact, there was a comment that was made by apparently Jared Kushner to one of the people working with him that all these deaths are happening in blue states and they're happening to black people. Why is this a problem for us?
Yeah, it's just so tragic and so cynical.
Yep.
Will there be accountability? Good question. I certainly hope so. I mean, we will have a chance to really confront Donald Trump again. I'm almost certain that he will be the Republican nominee. So we will have a chance to make him explain and to hold him accountable. And so, I mean, but it's just so cynical, so incredibly heartless, cold as ice, and just feeds into every negative fear that people have about trying to, about the barriers to a fair and just society.
Yep.
But there's no doubt in my mind, I could tell you, and I tell you, my mom was living in Detroit, and COVID was taking a heavy toll on Detroit, African-American people in Detroit. My mom was 82 years old, so she is a very healthy woman. She, you know, had been working up until January of that year. Very sad.
Yeah, yeah, it really is. I hope he is held accountable, and I'll ask Sean to forward to your folks the article, because I did the research on this. I think I've nailed it, that this was this was essentially a genocide, an intentional political act.
Mm-hmm. CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Back, we're talking with the former congressman representing Minnesota's 5th District and now the attorney general for the state of Minnesota since 2019, Keith Ellison. He's got a brilliant new book out, Breaking the Wheel, Ending the Cycle of Police Violence. And we spoke a few minutes ago about possible solutions to this. I mean, throughout your book, you're going through these trials, through the examples, through the difficult times, you know, one of the things I thought was really amazing during the prosecution chapter, you talk about the third paragraph of the Hennepin County complaint saying that Floyd was actively resisting being handcuffed when that wasn't true. I mean, it's like every level from the prosecutors, from the cops to the prosecutors to the court system seems to be stacked in favor of basically maintaining police violence, particularly police violence against minorities in this country. What can we do? We've got about 2.5 minutes.
Well, we've got to, first of all, prosecute crime, whether or not the person wears a badge or not. That is a very critical part of this. There's got to be a credible, people have to have a credible regard for the law. We also have to have administrative remedies. I mean, people need to get fired when they violate the rules. Derek Chauvin had 18 prior excessive force complaints, and he wasn't even in the top 10. Are not our manager, our middle managers, calling people in with excessive complaints saying, what's wrong with you? What's going on? How are you getting all these complaints? And so we've got to have a criminal justice response, and we have to stop this practice of impunity, and we've got to have realistic sanctions on people who have excessive complaints. Then things like training can really work. Then the chokehold thing can work. Then the no-knock warrant prohibitions can work. But we've got to start with the idea you commit a crime, you're going to have to face accountability, whether you have a badge or not.
That seems like an important place to start. Is there an issue around the way that we're training our police officers or our failure to train them? I mean, do we need national standards, for example?
The answer is yes, we do. But I just want to say I am for training. I'm all for better training. But what training did they need to get off George Floyd's neck after 9 minutes and 29 seconds?
You're
what
right.
They were trained to do CPR. They were trained to not do racial bias, you know, unleash their racial biases. How come a 9-year-old girl wanted to call the police on the police. I mean, to a certain extent, what is the training that you see that the Tyre Nichols alleged killers needed? I mean, they were trained. They were the elite force called the Scorpion or whatever. I mean, what do you, you know, so you get the guy who, Jason Van Dyke, who shot down Laquan McDonald, wrote in a report that he was coming at me with a knife that shows that he was going away from him.
Yeah.
What is the training was going to fix that?
So is it a hiring issue?
Well, I think it's an accountability issue. It is a culture issue.
Yeah.
And we've got to be able to say to managers, you know, sergeants, you cannot let this go. I mean, the culture has got to shift from one where doing a good job is rewarded and doing a bad job is punished. I'm sorry. That's just what is going to have to happen. I mean, but let me just tell you, Newark, New Jersey, Camden, New Jersey, they've seen success. Let's look at what they're doing.
Yeah, sounds like a plan. Attorney General Keith Ellison, the book is Break the Wheel, Ending the Cycle of Police Violence. General Ellison, it's always an honor and a pleasure to have you on our program. Thank you so much for dropping by today. Lawrence in Berkeley, California. Hey, Lawrence, what's on your mind today?
I believe it was a week ago before last Friday that you spoke about the fact that there are many millions of people whose votes are being suppressed in red states.
Mm-hmm.
And that's certainly true. Not only are they closing down voting booths and voting stations, they're closing down DMVs, you know, motor vehicle bureaus, so that people can't get IDs.
Yep.
But I have a suggestion, and I hope there are some Democrats listening, about how that can be overcome and how Democrats can be assured of winning next year.
Okay. I'm all ears.
And it's not through TV or radio or social media. There has to be community organizing in these sites where votes are suppressed, because people have to be told in person where they can vote, and they have to then be brought to the voting place, and there have to be large coalitions formed of churches, of unions, of civil rights groups, of neighborhood groups, all of which will be dedicated to getting people to the polls. And that has to be done. It has to be done starting fairly soon. And if, I don't know if the Democratic Party will do that, but there are so many progressive branches of the Democratic Party who might do it. But it has to be done. I believe that's the only way that we can win.
Yeah, I am with you. I agree. The Democratic Party has largely speaking, a money problem, a funding problem. But yeah, there is so much that needs to be done, and we need to, in particular, make sure that young people are signed up to vote. Thank you, Lawrence. Well said. Thank you, Walter in Northridge, California. Hey, Walter, what's on your mind today?
Well, I'm very glad to have the opportunity, and thank you and all the staff for such a wonderful job. The gentleman who preceded me, I completely agree with. And in fact, there are a couple of suggestions that I have that would be targets for good progressive suits. For example, organizations, for example, Americans for Democratic Action here in California, the California Democratic Council. And that is the 20 million, excuse me, people who have been cross-checked off the list ought to be a target for progressive groups to contact individually.
Yeah.
With the process they would go to independently, assure they were re-registered. And of that 20 million, about half didn't vote. I would assume that about half of those people would be so angry at being disenfranchised that they may well become strong voters. And of that 50% that were already voting, there would be a very strong likelihood they would continue to vote and they would become more Democratic. I assume the people cross-checked off were about 75 to 85% natural Democrats. The second thing that these progressive groups ought to do, and all of this is targeted at taking control of the Democratic Party. You're absolutely right. The party is an already in place institution. I was very active in it in the 80s. In fact, I ran Ted Kennedy's campaign in 1980 in the Western 14 states.
Wow.
We increased the voter registration by 4%. If you have progressives in there, in California Democratic Party meeting, lean heavily that way, my brother will be part of that honorable assemblage, then we could have, instead of the people running the party who are forcing the Democratic Party not to have aggressive messaging and to destroy it, they're owned by the same people that own the Republicans. We just have Republican light at the head of the Democratic Party. We need the Democratic strong, Democratic socialism, and the natural people to head. And secondly, another group that I urge you to continue adding to your admonition to people regarding the bad budget cuts from Mr. Biden to is the vets. I think that some of the perhaps there are some wavering mega people. I don't think there are many, but of all the appeals they would have, certainly the end of Social Security payments to people, and I do believe they'd stop. I don't believe the person saying they're going to be automatic is true. I think that they would stop. And I think that that's what Biden should assert, that when they cut off the funds, Social Security's checks may well stop. If it's not for sure, he could make it conditional. But the cuts to vets has got to be very offensive even to marginal megas, not many of them, but to undecided voters who may be substantially impressed by the megas, both Social Security and the cuts to the vets,
yeah.
I believe will be very strong.
Biden has been talking about both those things, Walter, and you know, the problem is that the media does not like repeating that because it looks bad on the Republicans, and then the media gets accused of having media bias and being left-wing. With regard to voting and reaching out to the voters who've been purged from the voting rolls, the problem right now, there's a nationwide system, it's called ERIC. It stands for the Electronic Registration Information Center. And ERIC is a clearinghouse that's designed to help states know when people have moved their location. So, if you move out of one state and into another state, ERIC is who lets your state know so that they can purge you from the old state and make sure that you're registered in the new, or reach out to you if you want to be registered in the new. And that would be the system through which you would find who has been purged. Well, red state after red state, I think we're up to now 10 or 12 red states just in the last year have withdrawn from ERIC. And they're doing this, in my opinion, I mean, none of them have come out and said why they're doing it. In fact, they're being very careful never to say why they're doing it. I believe they're doing it because this way they can continue to purge people from the voting rolls and not have any record of it. There's no way of knowing who is purged, you know, unless you do a FOIA filing, and that can take a year. So it's going to be a real challenge.
My thought is that people like Mr. Palace, Mr. Moore, yourself might in some sense have the ability to research and find out what laws may be in place that require, and some states may have laws that require that while they may withdraw from ERIC, the state may have the record.
Right. No, they do, and they're available. It's just the problem is extracting them from the state. It can be if the state fights you, it can be a process that can take a couple of years. But Walter, I love your ideas. And I'm not saying that, you know, we shouldn't be targeting people who've been purged. And those records do exist for many of these states. I think it's absolutely brilliant. Walter, I need to move along. Thank you for the call. Matthew in Orlando, Florida. Hey, Matthew, what's on your mind today?
Tom, thank you so much for the hard work you've been doing. I'm a long-term follower of you and one of your compatriots or often visitors from Democracy at Work. I also have been following him for years and years. And I want to thank you, and I just want to say that you must have some courage and abilities that I do not, because I see the police issue not so much being focused on the violence. You know, obviously it's important. It's important, but it's so distracting from the larger structural problems in association with politics and the ability to protest and the ability to organize and the ability to put together democratic procedures in the face of a system that knows what you're saying and what you're doing before you do. That the ability to tap into all aspects of the media that in your work as an activist and as someone trying to point out to the world that there's something behind the curtain that's not right. If you do that, then you're now a focus of attention because they've practically outlawed everything that is now considered to be good public policy. Like. Yeah.
It's a softer form of outlaw. You know, if you're progressive or you're putting out progressive messages on, for example, Facebook or Twitter, you're not going to get even a tenth of the reach. Well, I shouldn't cite a specific number, but you're not going to get anything close to the reach that you would get if you are a right winger. So, you know, it is a challenge, but my experience has been that it's more of it's kind of a soft oppression as opposed to the specific hard oppression. But, I get what you're saying. Matthew, thank you. Thanks for the call. Corinne in Muskegon, Michigan. Am I saying your name right?
It's Corinne.
Corinne. Hi, Corinne. What's up?
Yeah. Well, anyhow, I enjoyed your conversation with General Ellis. I kind of reminded me exactly how disgusting the Trump administration was administering their pandemic policy. But anyhow... You were talking about Gretchen Whitmer signing into law red flag laws. We have Ottawa County here in Michigan that their county board was kind of taken over by a PAC called Ottawa Impact. And today what they are doing is they are voting now, this county board, they are voting to call themselves a constitutional county.
Oh,
which basically is they're saying that, well, what they don't feel, if they don't, they're basically saying that, okay, the sheriff doesn't have to really listen to what the state says. If the state says this, then we don't have to listen to it,
right.
Pretty much.
Right.
And one of the people that they have on this as a county, their county administrator, by the way, is John Gibbs. John Gibbs was the person who primaried Peter Meyer in the 3rd Congressional District, and was beaten out by Hillary Scolton.
Yeah, yeah.
So now he's sitting on this board in Ottawa County, and they're basically going to vote on themselves being considered a constitutional county.
Right, which means basically that they don't have to follow the Constitution. I mean, I went through this with one of the co-founders of the Constitutional Sheriff's Organization, John Mack. Richard Mack, excuse me, was on our program a number of times back in the day, and I'm real familiar with their perspective.
Yeah, and so I just thought you might like to know that's what, you know, and people really, really need to follow who they are voting into these counties.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, because they're going local. They're trying to build from the bottom up, which is exactly how you want to build national power, and progressives need to be doing the same. Corinne, thank you very much for the call, and spot on. Well said. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. With higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. It's accessible from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/Hartman with two N's. netsuite.com/Hartman. That's netsuite.com/Hartman.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, We think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Russ in Seattle. Hey, Russ, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Well, thank you, Russ.
Thank you for all you, the good work you're doing. My question is, if Biden does indeed invoke the 14th Amendment this week or the next to unilaterally raise the debt ceiling, will it prevent the economy from crashing?
Because I think it will.
It's still going to be fine in the courts right away.
Right.
And they're saying there's not enough time.
It's going to be up to the courts. He will immediately be sued by the Republicans, probably right. At the Supreme Court. And although they may try to go to, to a federal district court someplace and get somebody like Matthew Kaczmarek, some right-wing crank that Trump put on the bench. But in all probability, they'll sue directly to the Supreme Court because it's a squabble between two branches of government. And if the Supreme Court says, okay, we're going to say you cannot make payments until we decide, then yes, we slide into a depression. If the Supreme Court says keep making the payments while we decide, then everything's good, although it's kind of nervous time. But I can't see any constitutional argument that the Supreme Court could make to say that we should ignore what the 14th Amendment says, we should ignore what the presentment clause says, we should ignore faithfully execute the laws clause says in Article 2 of the Constitution. I mean, there's multiple places in the Constitution that they would be ignoring Perry v. U.S. from the 1930s, the Supreme Court decision where the Supreme Court said the government has to pay its bills. I mean, there's plenty of precedent here on the side of Joe Biden. So I'm not real worried about it. I don't think that it's going to crash our economy, and I think this might be the end of the road for the Republicans. What do you think, Russ?
Yeah, I totally agree, but then I keep reading that even Biden said that there won't be enough time to prevent the economy from crashing because it's gummed up in the court system.
Well, that was his concern. He said that's why he's procrastinating. But that would only be the case if the court enjoined the Biden administration from paying our bills. And I don't think these guys on the court, I mean, they're under so much pressure right now. You had Harlan Crowe just came out and said, I'm not going to tell Congress anything about what I gave Clarence Thomas. Screw you guys. I don't think they want the heat that would come with it. There's no benefit to them outside of hurting Joe Biden, but I don't think they're going to do it. Russ, I got to run, but thank you for the call. It's great to hear from you. I hope you call again. Dan in Portland, Maine. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind?
How are you doing?
Good. What's up?
Hey. I had a question about that ban on exporting fossil fuels. Do you know if that would include natural gas?
It could. The public citizen assertion, and there's 70 environmental groups, by the way, that have signed on to this, are calling for a ban on both oil and natural gas. I didn't call for natural gas in my op-ed because right now we're in the middle of this weird dance with Europe where we're supplying them with liquid natural gas to make up for what they've lost from the pipelines from Russia. And I didn't want to complicate things. And I think crude oil is probably going to be a huge step and probably going to be a bigger lift than they can pull off anyway. But I'd like to see them both banned, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's why I was asking, because I knew we were sending a lot. I actually work in the gas industry, and there's a lot of gas in Ohio and Pennsylvania that's getting liquefied and sent elsewhere.
That's right.
And I'm in favor of not doing that. I realize there's an issue with that Nord Stream pipeline and Europe needing gas, but living in New England, we could have really used that gas when it was the heating oil this winter was like $6 a gallon. That crippled people,
yeah.
And there's such an abundance of natural gas in Pennsylvania and Ohio.
Yep.
And we just can't get it to New England because of the restrictions on pipelines through certain states.
Yep.
But yet they're liquefying it and sending it overseas. It just doesn't make sense to me as a citizen of this country.
I agree with you, Dan. I absolutely agree. I just the reason why I didn't, include that, like I said, was because of the complexities right now of the politics around Ukraine. But
yeah.
But, if we could ban the exports of crude oil first and then look at natural gas, next year or something like that, I'm all in favor of it. Dan, thank you for the call. John in Portland. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. A while ago, you were talking about the amount of money that's in the national debt. And you said that 40% of it had been accrued under Trump. Two things about that. I think that, A, that was necessary, and, B, I keep that separate than the amount that's been spent on needless wars over the last 30 years. But my main question is, if the 40% of it is Trump, and that came out to like $7 or $8 trillion, from what I remember you saying.
Yeah, that's not 40% of $32 trillion. Let me amend that. I have seen this. You know, Trump was responsible for 40% of the national debt number repeatedly in the media. I believe that actually it was like 40% of the national deficit going into the Biden administration. It's playing with numbers. Here's the Trump ran up to $7.6 trillion in national debt, plus the Trump tax cuts. Every year that they're still in place, it's another couple hundred billion dollars added to our national debt. So, you know, if you space it out over a decade or out over two decades or something like that, you might have some really massive number. But just to simplify it, you know, we've got a $32 trillion national debt. Trump added $7.6 trillion to it. If you want to cut some of the national debt, just reverse the Trump tax cuts. That was about half of it, and a little less than half of it, to just, you know, super simplify it. But, yeah, I'm going to stop quoting that 40% number until I figure out exactly. You know, I've seen the administration use that number. I saw it this morning on MSNBC, and, you know, so I was just doing it off the top of my head, but I don't understand exactly how they're getting to that. The 25% number, which is what Biden originally said, he got fact-checked on that by the New York Times, and they said, yes, you're absolutely right. Donald Trump is responsible for 25% of the national debt. And that makes sense. You know, seven times four is 28. And it's 7.6, and plus there's more than that. And that was as of, you know, the end of 2020 when he left office. So now you've got two more years of the Trump tax cuts still being in place. So that makes sense. John, thanks for the call. And it's a good one. And I need to keep my numbers straight and clean here and, you know, make sure that the messaging is easily understood. So thank you for that. Terry in Ventura, California, watching us on Free Speech TV. What's on your mind, Terry?
Correct, Tom. Thanks, Tom. Tom, at the very moment you were talking about the political violence that is more endemic in our political system right now, I was reading an article in my most recent Nation called COVID Has Left Deep Wounds in America's Rural Community. And after I describe my view, I have one sentence which I think really gets across the message of this.
Okay.
But, Tom, the message in this, which I read, is science versus superstition is as old as when we emerged from the Dark Ages, no?
Yeah.
And so this article, really, have you ever gotten off the freeway and landed in a rural community and noticed how dilapidated it has? The same basic economic problems that we have in our ghettos, Tom.
Oh, and I used to live in rural Vermont and in rural New Hampshire. I completely understand rural poverty. It's a real thing. And these were white communities, by the way.
Tom, ironically, this article in the current Nation is by an Ann Suskin, who is a public policy specialist from Dartmouth. Mm-hmm. And it talks about the problems in Northeast Vermont and that little part of Vermont during
COVID. It's called the Northeast Kingdom.
Yep. That's what she calls it.
Yep.
And
we used to live right on the edge of it.
And I understand. Right. Well, anyway, you know, when we use phraseology such as, because I think we're afraid when we go in rural communities because, you know, that is where hunting and guns are more popular and we're a little worried. We use phrases such as, flyover states and spreadnecks. Spreadnecks was a word she used, you know, when we attack people who don't use science to prevent COVID.
It's not a word heard before, but keep going.
Well, anyway, among the people who live in rural communities, we have to convince them that Republican budgets and why our insurance system is the cause for them to have healthcare deserts the way we have food deserts in our in our urban communities. But this one sentence, I really think, speaks to the issue of this article. I hope all will read. The village mentality that permeates rural communities will crack through our society's buckling foundation of toxic individuality. I think that's pretty critical.
I think the larger problem, and I certainly saw this when we lived in rural Vermont. I mean, we lived out in the woods, but we were associated with a little town that had about 300 people in it. And half the houses had cars on blocks in their yards, you know. And everybody listened to the local right-wing radio station. There was no local
left-wing. A little different from Appalachia,
radio.
Right?
Yeah. No, I mean, it was very much like Appalachia. In fact, some out-of-towners had moved in, and they got a thing before the city council to say it was a $25 a year fine if you had a car on blocks in your front yard. And the locals staged a revolt, took back the city council, and passed a fine and passed a law saying that there was a $25 fine if you didn't have a car on blocks in your front yard. I mean,
it's messaging, right, Tom?
It was wild.
To both deprived elements. Again, it's messaging to both elements, right, Tom?
I'm with you. Terry, thank you for the call. Spot on. Picking up your calls here, Roya in Los Angeles. Hey, Roya, thanks for listening to KPFK. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I just wanted to give a shout out to Daniel Goldman right now. I think he's doing an amazing job. He's the only one that's like, you know, fighting George Santos, and then he was like meeting with the whistleblowers, and like he called them out on like Cash Patel's, you know, fake or whatever. But I just think he's doing a lot over there, and
he really
he's
is.
A fighter.
Yeah. Yeah, he's on, is it the Weaponization Committee or the Judiciary Committee where he's dueling with Jim Jordan? I can't keep track of
it. I believe it's the Judiciary one that he's like, yeah, I mean, that Jim Jordan needs to be, like, you know, knocked out real hard. But I'm just saying, Daniel Goldman, man, he's got the, you know, fight these guys.
He definitely does.
And I think he was amazing in the first impeachment as well of Donald Trump because he did an amazing job.
Yeah, he was the lawyer then.
And he's on our side.
Yeah, he absolutely is. And then he was the lawyer for the January 6th committee, and now he's in Congress. And God bless him. He is one. This
That's
is a guy
what I'm
who's going places.
About.
This is a guy
That's
who's.
That's what I'm saying. I think he's going to have a bright future, and I'm so stoked that he's on our team, you know?
Yeah, I'm with you. Roya, thank you. Spot on. I join your shout-out to Daniel Goldman. Thank you. Morris in Long Beach, California. Hey, Morris, thank you for listening to KPFK. What's up?
Well, first of all, I want to say I love you, Tom Hartman.
Well, back at you, Morris.
Good morning, everybody, within the sound of my voice. Let me tell you something, Tom. We got this in the bag. All Papa Joe's got to do is go on national television, fireside chat. Remember Franklin Delano Roosevelt? We had to read about him when we were living. But we do remember Ronald Reagan. Remember Ronald Reagan? Speak directly to the people. Describe. What the Republican agenda is all about, Tom, how they're challenging free speech, how they're attacking our institutions. They even fooled with Mickey Mouse. They're trying to fight Mickey Mouse.
Yeah.
And explain to the American people that the MAGA Republicans, don't call them Republicans, call them the MAGA Republicans are insurrectionists, okay? They are fascistic. And they are attacking, along with trying to disrupt our social programs, you know, that kind of stuff. They could organize a whole lot better than me. But the main thing here is all he's got to do is sit down in a little rocking chair, a little fireplace behind him, got a little dog with him or something, and just explain to the American people, not the intellectuals like you and me, but the common folk, man, the 9 to 5, the Walmart people, and let them know what the Republican agenda is. They are trying to disrupt, take whatever quality of life you got. They're trying to make it worse. And go right on down the list. And I guarantee you, he'll kick everybody's butt.
I agree.
Behave yourself, Frank.
I absolutely agree, Morris. Morris just hung up. I don't know if you caught it, Morris, or anybody else who's watching or listening right now. I believe it was on NPR this morning, but somebody made the comment that this is about Ron DeSantis, but I think it could be generalized to Republicans in general, that Ron DeSantis is getting his ass handed to him by Cinderella. And that can't be a good look in Republican world, right? I mean, the GOP, they're all about this, oh, we're these macho men, you know, we've got our guns and we've got our AR-15s and we've got our big flags. They're even bigger than a real flag. And, you know, we've got our pickup trucks. But you're having your ass handed to you by Cinderella. Not going to work. It's not going to work. We'll be right back. Well, maybe it will. I don't know. What do you think? I don't think it's going to work. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Eric in Fountain Valley, California. Hey, Eric, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I kind of went ballistic this morning. I tuned in to the beginning of your show, as I always do, and SiriusXM has the AP News blurbs to start off the top of the hour, and they were talking about the debt ceiling, and she made the statement, if a debt ceiling agreement is not reached, it will be on President Joe Biden. And I had to listen to it again and make sure I got it right.
Yeah.
And I'm sure she was trying to state an opinion, or they were trying to state an opinion.
That is the Republican talking point.
This is the state. How can we let this continue? This is a once reputable news organization that now has become a right-wing propaganda arm. I would suggest everybody, and I've done this before, and it's not easy to get a hold of them, everybody listening on SiriusXM, to please again reach out to them and say, we do not want the stinking AP right-wing propaganda arm at the top of your news hour.
I think you might have a more effective, you know, nothing wrong with lobbying, you know, SiriusXM or any radio station that carries our program or any other program for that matter, any media outlet. And you can do that, and they do monitor their Facebook and Twitter feeds and probably other social media as well. But I think that you might have more success going directly to AP and pointing out that right-wing bias, right-wing talking points have made their way into their news reports, and you've got a problem with that.
Okay, I'll try that too.
Yeah, yeah. That's where I would start, because that's really the source of the problem. And frankly, I'd much rather have AP News at the top of the hour than Fox News at the top of the hour, which is on some networks and some stations.
But I mean, how can you be more blatantly propagandist than that? I mean, it's gotten bad.
Yeah, it has. Yeah, I don't disagree, Eric. Thank you for the call. Sandy in La Mesa, California. Hey, Sandy, what's on your mind today?
Yes, I just wanted to ask a question about the whistleblowers, or quote-unquote whistleblowers for the FBI.
At the Weaponization Committee, you're talking about Jim Jordan's committee?
Yeah, specifically the whistleblowers themselves. It sounds like one of their complaints was that they were unable to find another job for over a year.
Yeah, because they've been fired by the FBI for refusing to do their jobs.
So is that true? They can't go find some work somewhere else?
Well, they could probably get a job at Burger King, but, you know, what police agency wants to hire a guy who got fired from the FBI for refusing to do his job? They refused to go out and serve warrants on people who were in January 6th insurrectionists.
It's just like they were, I don't know, they were asking people to feel sorry for them because they made it sound like the FBI wouldn't allow them to work anywhere.
Oh, that's crazy. Yeah, no, they could have got a, they probably,
I couldn't find it anywhere. So
yeah, got jobs at local police departments or something. I mean, there's a big difference. I mean, you know, being an agent, a special agent with the FBI pays really well. And, you know, it's a very high status, high prestige job. And if you blow it, if you refuse to do your job and you get fired by the FBI itself, that's it. You know, that's a career ender. And appropriately so, I would say. And it turns out that these guys were being paid by Kash Patel. And one of them testified before under oath that he didn't, which is a 5-year felony, by the way. Is Congress going to hold them to account? No, because Kevin McCarthy is running the show. But he apparently lied about it. So, Sandy, you got to run, but thank you for the call. Spot on. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Exposing the con in conservative. I'll be right back. Scott in Denver. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind today?
I was looking at the fundamentalist Christian beliefs on the curse of Eve and the curse of Ham to justify the violence and hatred and cruelty that slavery, Jim Crow, lynching, and you know about the curse of Ham and
blackness.
Blackness, right. Yeah.
Although there are some, the Mormon Church used to teach that was the curse of Cain, but in any case, keep going.
Yes, I've heard that. And that I think, you know, that I saw Inherit the Wind about a week ago with the Scopes trial, mm-hmm. and it's such a good argument against that literal. And, you know, that people and that 30% of the population believe that Adam and Eve were real people and that Eve was made from his rib to be his helpmate, and her sexuality was evil, and women are either virgins or mothers or whores. And I think, you know, that the guy you had on last week who talked about the dopamine and testosterone you get from a sense of power. Because the lynchings, I mean, there were 7,000 that have been
These people are getting high on it.
Yes.
They're quite literally getting high on killing people. I'm with you. Thank you very much for that. Bill in Sierra Blanca, Texas. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I really enjoyed your show. I learned a lot. Thanks for all your hard work.
You're welcome.
I wanted to comment, Tom, on those natural gas exports.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's several proposed through Texas from the gathering station in Fort Stockton near southeastern New Mexico. It's a huge area near the Permian Basin, and it's all for export to Asia and Europe. They would go through Mexico, and they would require a presidential permit. As you know, Tom, natural gas is a very strong climate producer.
Right. It's methane, and methane is about 80 times more potent a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide is for the first, I think it's 27
it's actually,
years is the half-life.
It's a bigger disruptor than coal when you take into account from cradle to grave all of the activities, inventing and burning and all that stuff.
Yep.
But in any case, having said that, Tom, President Biden would have to approve this through the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Actually, they would approve it.
FERC, yeah.
And it's going to be a hard sell because oil and gas has a lot of clout. Mm-hmm. And 1OK just bought Magellan. This is the company wanting to do the pipeline through my home in Sierra Blanca that would go to the river and then eventually to Mexico where they'd build an LNG facility to export the gas overseas. None of the gas, Tom, would be used for Texas or Mexico.
Right.
And it would, like your previous caller said, it would drive the gas prices up in the United States.
That's right. That's why these companies are exporting oil and gas, is because it actually increases their profit margins. They produce it cheaply here and sell it overseas for a high price, and then they bring in overseas stuff and mark it up, but they use that high price, they justify their high prices by the world spot prices. You're absolutely right, Bill. And I, you know, I'm all in favor of banning all fossil fuel exports. We also have a problem exporting coal. We're shipping coal to China, you know, via long, mile-long trains that go through my town. So I'm with you. Bill, thank you for the call. Denise in Calumet, Michigan. Hey, Denise, what's on your mind today?
Well, I was just thinking about how every time the economy crashes and the rich get richer. Well, I was a victim of the 2008 crash, and it was too late for my 401k to build up. And I was in the era where we started out with pensions, and then they made everybody, and healthcare, they made everybody move into these 401k systems.
Right.
But I didn't have time to make up the money. And these young people don't realize, the younger people growing up don't realize how important Social Security is, because they're going to just go through crash after crash after crash, losing what they've put in. And they'll be like me, where I lost two-thirds of mine and how many other people. So I have to have my Social Security.
Yeah.
Because my retirement is not enough.
Yeah, I totally get it. Yeah, Social Security is an essential safety net, and it has proved its worth, and it's been with us for close to 100 years now. And the Republicans, during that entire time, I mean, literally from the first day it was put into place in 1935 up till today, Republicans have been trying to shut it down and move it over to the big banks, to their funders. So, yeah, I get it. Denise, thank you. Thank you for sharing that story. Hopefully people are listening. I appreciate it. Mike in Hope Sound, Florida. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Mike and Brian here. Just want to bring up that mention what you just said, which unfortunately I'm right again, because 6 months ago I said that Elon Musk would be standing on a stage with Ron DeSantis. And it's not because I'm a psychic. Fascists will stick together.
Yep.
I ask everyone to please look at this, that Ron DeSantis called for all anti-vaccine cops to come to Florida for bonuses, including the ones who had felony charges, one with a murder charge sitting on him. And he accepted these people because he knows that the police, as you mentioned before, are going to be the strong arm or the so-called brown shirts of his push towards power. Elon Musk has a long history of slander and of conspiracy theories. He's a very dangerous, intelligent man who's going to be around for a long time. So please, people, put these people under a microscope. And I'm praying that we don't lock Trump away before he loses in 2024. Let's keep him hanging around long enough to do our dirty work for us.
Yeah, well, it looks like he's going to really drag down the GOP, and I think that's a good thing. I don't believe he's electable. Although, you know, I didn't believe he was electable in 2016. So, you know, one of the things we learn is that anything can happen, particularly when Vladimir Putin decides he's going to help out. I don't think it's going to work this time. And if the Republicans don't have him at the top of the ticket, he's going to do everything he can to destroy the ticket, which is going to make for interesting theater, get out the popcorn kind of stuff. Mike, thanks for the call. And thank you for being with us today. We'll be back same time, same place. In the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires all of us, and that includes you. So get out there, get active. Double check your voter registration, by the way, especially if you live in a red state and you've ever registered as a Democrat. They're coming for you. So double check it. Do it every couple months. Make sure that your voter registration is still intact. There's elections this November, statewide elections all across the country, plus, you know, a year from now, the big one. So get out there, get active, tag You're It. Have a great afternoon.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.